Nine Bright Shiners is a new collection from Theo Dorgan, in which, amongst other things, he reflects on the death of loved ones as well as on his own mortality. Theo is with me in studio this evening. Let's start straight away with a poem, if we could, Theo, and one called Michael Michael. I think it'll become clear who the Michael is fairly quickly.
I should say that Michael, it's called that because nobody ever addressed Michael once, because especially as he was in his last years, it was always Michael Michael. Michael, I was on the East Link in a taxi when the nurse in my ear said, soft and sad, I'm afraid your friend is dead. A wind out of Munster shook the bridge. We stopped and I stepped to the parapet. October flowed in the black Liffey below, ebb tide by the slanting buoys. A wind out of Munster shook the bridge. I closed my eyes, went down and in for O'Rahilla O'Brother, that stiff-eyed company of the living still. A wind out of Munster shook the bridge. A wren darted from hedge to hedge and they followed it with their eyes. Hands lifted in welcome, a wind out of Munster shook the bridge. The wren became a wraith, became a stately air, turned in the bony hands of a watchful piper. A wind out of Munster shook the bridge. What shall we do for timber? The last of the woods are down and our quiet master down. I got back in. We drove to the toll. A wind out of Munster shook the bridge. The driver paid and asked, was I all right? Would we go on? Drive on, I said. Drive on. He was a good man. And the wind behind me shook the bridge.
Theo Dorgan reading Michael Michael from his new collection, Nine Bright Shiners. Michael Hartnett, for whom that was written. The refrain in the midst of all of that, Theo, a wind out of Munster shook the bridge. Is that your own line or was that a Hartnett line or what is it?
Well, you see, Michael was a great poet of Munster, and Munster was a kind of the temenos for him. Munster was sacred ground for Michael in much the same way that Northern Ireland was for Heaney or Simmons or Montague or Mahon. And I suppose Michael embodied a certain spirit of Munster, a certain sweetness out of Munster, but also a memory of the 17th century and the 18th century when so much of Munster poetry, especially in Irish, was informed by what was happening in Spain, in France and in Italy at the time. I mean, the bulk of 17th century Irish poetry is hugely influenced by Spanish poetry and French poetry. And Michael embodied that kind of cosmo. I always thought Michael was kind of like a Spanish Hidalgo of the 17th century. You could easily see him strolling down the street like Tybalt with the hand on the pommel of the sword, ready to take offence at an insult to a lady. He had that dark
quality
to him, you know. But a marvellous poet and a very gentle man. But there was steel behind the gentleness, you know.
It's one of several poems in this particular collection, and I'll come to the title of the collection and the title poem in a second. But the second section of the five in the book is called The Dead Stand All Around Us. And there are several of the poems in that section in particular that have in memoriam written after them. But various dates when it comes to the people you're commemorating. 1997 in the case of Lark Cassidy, 2006 in the case of John McGahern, 1999 in the case of Deirdre Meaney. So were these poems written over a long period of time, or did you just find yourself writing a lot of these elegies recently?
Well, some of them go back to their occasions. I mean, Lark Cassidy, for instance, goes back to there. But you know yourself, Sean, you write a poem and it doesn't have its book yet and you put it to one side and it waits. And there are some poems here that go back a long time. And then there was maybe an acceleration towards the end as the threads started to gather in. And I suppose one poem begets another too, in the sense that, you know, if you think about how we lost Lar, who was a great champion of the arts, and then we lose John McGahern. And Michael Hartnett actually had a great phrase, the long subtraction has begun. And I suppose I became conscious as I began to look at what was moving towards a book of that subtraction and of what it means and its implications for all of us.
Did you feel yourself getting closer to the equal sign, as it were?
Well, you know, if you look at these online surveys, there's a category that goes 55, 60, 65, 60, 65, and then 65 dash. And I find that dash, it's up a bit down the road now, but, you know, it's very ominous, that dash, you know. And of course, it's an absurdity because I mean, if you look at what people are doing, you know, great artists, great writers are doing in their 70s and in their 80s, there's no retiring. And in fact, it's entirely possible. If you look at Picasso, for instance, who was painting with the same extraordinary vigor and openness right to the very end. The inventiveness that goes with art, I suppose it's one of the few consolations for living in penury all your life, is that not only do you not retire, you can't retire.
And you'll be used to the penury by the time you're 75
and
or 80.
And I suppose, too, we accumulate our dead. And I think we have a living relationship with the dead. I have no sense, really, that Michael is gone. I wouldn't be in the least surprised to turn the corner by Grogan's and South William Street and have that Castilian flourish with the hat and the cane, you know? And perhaps there's a sense in which there is no death, that, you know, people live on in memories. Maybe that's part of the business of art, is to give, what does Shakespeare say, so long lives this and this gives life to thee.
Which in some ways leads us directly into the title of the collection and the title poem, Nine Bright Shiners. Where does it come from, first of all? You show us at the beginning of the book, but for those who don't know.
Well, I suppose, oddly enough, it comes from having once been a Boy Scout. And we had a marching song, Green Grow the Rushes, Oh. It's a very, very old song and a very mysterious song. And I found myself with a sequence of nine elegies. And of course, you know, I've been doing a lot of sailing on and off over the years. And, you know, you think of the stars as orientation marks, you know. And perhaps I thought in the great sort of dark vault of a life that the dead as much as the living are kind of stars shining at you. So I had this sequence, Nine for the Nine Bright Shiners. And then I thought, yeah, that wouldn't be a bad title because it has a lot in it. Now, I did get an email from a friend saying, is that Nine for the Nine Bright Shiners?
I did have to check that it was actually spelled Shiner.
I said I'd just let that one go past. But it's an old song and it's a ballad. And I like the idea of the... like, if you look at the words of the ballad, I quote some of it in the epigraph to the book. They're really quite mysterious, you know. 11 for the 11 who went to heaven, 10 for the 10 commandments, 9 for the 9 bright shiners, 8 for the April rainers, 7 for the 7 stars in disguise, 6 for the 6 proud walkers. Six proud walkers, who are they?
It's a bit like the magpie rhyme, isn't it?
And it is. And it's a kind of a magpie song because it draws in out of the Egyptian tradition, out of the Christian tradition. It draws in out of gypsy ballads. You know, so the song itself, and there we were as, you know, in our short trousers with the socks held up by green elastic garters, marching out from Dublin Hill, you know, heading out towards Kerry Pike or whatever, singing away. But the song could be 600, 700 years old. We had no more idea. And there's that, I suppose, is also part of the business of the poet, is recuperation, recovering memory, bringing things back into the language.
It strikes me, now, there are, as I said, that particularly in that section, the dead stand all around us, there are quite a few in memoriam poems in there. But there are other sections of the book which are, particularly the final section, I thought, was about count your blessings, as if your mother had said to you, count your blessings.
Well, I tell myself two things every day. You're going to die, and aren't you lucky to be still here? And I mean, there are actually a lot of love poems in this. When I sent the manuscript off to Pat Bourne and Dedalus Press, I sent him a warning. I was saying, this is dark stuff. And it was only after we'd settled down and the notes were coming back and the first proof came back, I discovered, actually, there are a lot of love poems in there, and poems of gratitude for being beloved and gratitude for having had the opportunity to show love to so many people. And
the one you're going to read for us now is a particular example of that. And quite a simple type of, this is a Night Walk with the Dog Bella, page 133 if you're searching for it there.
I was actually.
Yeah. Night
I'm
Walk
still
with
not
the Dog
familiar
Bella.
Enough with this to know what's where, you know. Yeah, we had a great dog. She was half rough collie, half retriever, a really smart creature, you know. And she was a great mood barometer. You know, you'd watch, if the dog had the head down and was looking at you, you'd think, maybe there's something we need to sort out here, you know. She was a great relationship counsellor, the same dog.
But she sensed it before it happened.
You see, we were so many in my family, we never had dogs growing up. So this was actually my first dog. She died 2.5 years ago. It took us 2.5 years to replace her. We have a lunatic at the minute called Rio. We call him Rio Loco. He's probably at home now chewing his way through the kitchen furniture.
And how long had you had Bella for?
We had Bella for nearly 12 years.
Right.
And, you know, in Buddhists, they say, you know, you should respect all living beings. And I suppose, you know, notionally, I understood that. But looking at a dog and watching a dog and realizing these are not just sentient beings, they have their own particular kind of consciousness. They maneuver in the world, they evaluate things and people, they make decisions. And it was lessons about how everything in existence is one way or another sentient and conscious, you know. This is called Night Walk with the Dog Bella. The tide is going out on the Borough Beach, the long murmur, the suck and hiss. Night, and the islands under the full moon float at their moorings, nudge and shove. One of those nights when talk's beyond our reach, each of us wearing a single glove, the better to hold hands. You scuff your shoes, the dog carefully watching our every move. And this is all we need to know of love. Three souls walking the beach, the tide going out that will come in again, the dog content, the fated stars above. Still silent, buoyant, we stop, we turn to kiss, and the black dog goes chasing down the moon.
Theo Dorgan reading Night Walk with the Dog Bella from his new collection, Nine Bright Shiners. I mentioned that, you know, obviously that's the counting of the blessings, and we've touched on the In Memoriam poems that are there. When you did those contemplations around the deaths of others, did it make you maybe face your own mortality, or did you just fleetingly look at that and move on?
Well, I wouldn't want to mislead you, Sean. I mean, I think about my own mortality all the time, you know, because there is so much in the world and so much to be done and so much to be learned, so much to be enjoyed that there are never enough hours in a day. I suppose it made me think of fading powers, and it made me think too of the arbitrary subtractions. There are people gone from us who should have lived hereafter. I mean, you think of that outpouring of grief that's still pouring down the slopes when Seamus Heaney died. And, you know, grief is a strange, grief is also a continuity, you know. We mourn those who've gone. But our instinct, and it's one of the deeper instincts of poetry, is to memorialise, to hold people still in our consciousness, in our hearts, in our attention. And I know I get into terrible fits of temper with the brutal way the state is being mismanaged, and it's not because politics is a hobby, it's because people are not allowed the space to grow into their full human dignity, to behave with dignity, to have their dignity respected, and the dignity of people attempting to be beloved of others and to show love to others, that's at the heart of everything. It's at the heart of everything we do.
In fact, that might bring us to the very first section in the book, which struck me as the most material in some ways of the five sections that are there, Messages from the World. It starts with you standing, in fact, outside the Dáil on yeah. Kildare Street, looking in and watching things happening there. Was it important for you to, as well as look at those memorials and the other aspects, the blessings and things like that that we've spoken about, was it important for you to place it very much in the world in which we live, the poems that you write?
It is, because all poets live in the same world as everyone who's alive at the same time as them. You know, we don't have there isn't a rarefied zone that poets go to put the back of the hand to the brow and look poetic, you know, looking off into the distance. We all live in the same world, and there is only one world. And just as there is only one life, you have one life and you have to live as best you can. And I have to say, it has always offended me. I suppose perhaps it comes from having the advantage of an education and the advantage of having grown up poor. And you understand that power and powerlessness are very much part of the dynamic of the living world. And, you know, somebody who wants to cherish her children but is terrified that she won't be able to pay the bills at the end of the month is being put at a severe disadvantage as a mother, as a friend, as a companion, as a partner. And so it does, the state does impinge on how we love each other. The state does impinge on how we take care of each other. It also sets the tone. And the tone in Ireland, the tone as set by people who lust after power, is a very ugly one in the present time. I'm also conscious, I'm afraid, that when you look back down through Irish history and those who had visions for the nation, and if you think of Parnell, you think of Collins, you think of Connolly, and you look at what we've had in the last 2 or 3, I do not think history will remember these people.
I want you to finish by reading one of the poems from that material section, as I'm calling it, the first section. This is A Woman in Winter. It's on page 36 of the collection there. Theo Dorgan's latest collection, Nine Bright Shiners. And here is one of the poems from the opening section, A Woman in Winter.
Which I think actually is kind of curious, in its own curious way, a Christmas poem. Don't ask me why. Maybe I see it. But I'd be the last person to understand these poems.
Nine and a half weeks to go,
by the way. You have to read the book and tell me what they mean. A Woman in Winter. She walks the ditch, contented and alone. Sends up a flight of crows with every stone. Beyond the ridge, beyond the frost-gripped fence, the light pours down on lands of innocence. A tree stands out against the winter snow, a tree her mother planted years ago. The sun flares up and shines through bitter cold on sudden flashing ornaments of gold.
Theo Dorgan with A Woman in Winter from his new collection, Nine Bright Shiners. The book is published by Daedalus Press. More information on daedaluspress.com.